Mr. Bailey, real too?
They are extremely patriotic, but not always reliable. In other words, if you wanted to set up a meeting, it was very difficult to pin them down to a specific time. And however important an operation might be, it was always difficult to get everybody there on time, at the same time, to undertake the same plan. They were certainly keen to get at the Germans, but I think politics interfered in, to some extent, with their patriotism, so that they were divided between the communists and the socialists, and probably some royalists too, if you did but know. And this sort of divide was evident in the setup of the various resistance cells.
In what circumstances did you come across the political aspect?
Well, wherever you met, politics was the main subject of conversation. Not what you'd done to attack the Germans, or what information you'd secured, or anything to do with the operations that you had in mind. Always politics. And I mentioned this to them at the time, you know, where we used to eat in a cafe in Bertuy, and I mentioned this to them, and they said, yes, politics are important to us. And that was something, I think, which English people would find difficult to understand in the situation of an occupied country.
When you say politics was a topic of conversation, you mean the question of who was to hold power when the Germans were driven out?
Yes. They were all struggling to assume power when the Germans went, so that the communists, who were quite strong at the time and probably the best organised, were anticipating that they would be the most powerful force in France after the war, but this proved to be not the case. And then there were the Gaullists, who, generally speaking, were socialist. I will say they all seemed to support General de Gaulle. They all thought he was a wonderful chap. But apart from that, politics, to me, loomed far too large for an occupied country.
Did they pass any opinion about the Vichy regime and Marshal Pétain?
Oh yes, they were, I think, embarrassed to some extent by the Vichy regime, and of course determined to oust it at the earliest opportunity. And after we'd been overrun, it was very obvious that anybody who'd collaborated with the Germans had a very rough passage. Unfortunately, there were groups of people called the September Partisans, who arose after the British and Americans had overrun the area, who were particularly vicious against collaborators, although they'd done nothing to help free the country.
Did you see anything of the activities of the September Partisans?
Yes, the shaving of women collaborators, and some very rough treatment for milices, as they were called. Yes, they had a tough time afterwards, probably rightly so.
Were they put to death?
I never saw anybody killed, no. Just generally beaten up.
What was the attitude of the French people, the French civilians and the resistance towards Britain and British people?
Yes, I think they were pleased with the golden egg that we were able to lay. In other words, they wanted the supplies that we could bring. I'm not sure that they really wanted us to interfere with the running of the various resistance units. this was my experience. It was probably different in other units, perhaps. But my impression was they wanted us there for the supplies that we could bring in and the help that we could give them. But they generally wanted to control their own operations.
Did you ever come across any hostility from French people because of events that had happened in the war, like the bombardment at Merz El Kebir or Dunkirk?
No.
Did you come across any French VIPs whilst you were there?
No.
What did the standard of living of the French people seem to be like? Did it surprise you, or was it what you expected?
No, they were quite strained as far as food resources were concerned. It was black bread when it was available, no meat, an egg now and again if you were lucky. We used to provide some bully beef here and there. But no, rations were short. There seemed to be a fair amount of drink available. No coffee, of course, it was acorns.
Now, you were just about to tell me about how you were selected to go to Southeast Asia. Can you take the story up from there, please?
Yes. We were recalled to London and sent out to Ceylon, where we undertook jungle training and where we set up further teams of three. And there it was perhaps I should mention that after France, the French Jedburghs generally went to French Indochina doing the same sort of work. And the Americans generally went to China, again doing the same sort of job. Whereas the British contingent went to Burma and Malaya. Now, it wasn't only Jedburghs who went there. People who'd been involved in other resistance forces in Yugoslavia, Greece, and Albania also found their way out to the Far East and operated in these teams of three. We were known as Force 136. I joined up with Major McCool and a captain whose name, I'm afraid, I just can't remember. And our code name was Cal. The method of operation was very similar to France, but of course translated to a jungle warfare.
What was the background of these two officers? Had they any knowledge of
Yes, no knowledge of Southeast Asia, but they've both been in other resistance areas. McCool was in Greece, and the other chap was in Yugoslavia.
Do you remember from which units in the British Army they had come from?
No. I know one of the captain, whose name I can't remember, was a regular soldier. But McCool was hostilities only.
Were they the same age as you?
No, they were a fair bit older than me. I'm probably approaching the 30 mark.
What else can you say about the training in preparations in Ceylon?
Well, we did a few jungle exercises while we were in Ceylon, partly in the rainy season, I have to say, and it was fairly unpleasant. But largely it was a question of acclimatising ourselves to the tropics before we went into Burma. My team was dropped to a local reception committee, that is a Burmese reception committee, on the 30th of April 1945, Incidentally, we arrived in Ceylon in February 45.
What kind of plane took you to Burma?
This was a Liberator, again.
With an American crew?
No, British crew, RAF crew.
Do you remember whereabouts in Burma it was?
Yes, it was just north of Mul Mine, near a town called Thaton, T-H-A-T-O-N.
Was the drop straightforward, or did you have any problem?
No problem. I landed in a tree, but fortunately it was a young sapling, and it bent over just enough to put me on the ground, which was fortunate.
And did they have the same reception committee with the same signalling system?
Yes, except it was fires. They lit fires in the form of an arrow pointing in the wind direction.
What did you make of the reception committee?
Very good. The Burmese agent who was there, who was English-speaking, was a first-class chap. He had a nom de guerre. I never knew his real name, but his nom de guerre was Kin Saul. But he was obviously well-educated and spoke perfect English.
Were they in uniform?
No.
Were you in uniform?
Yes.
Same as before?
Yes.
And was your equipment the same?
Similar equipment, yes, except that we didn't have suitcase sets, because the suitcases wouldn't have lasted in the jungle. We had them all in canvas packs. But it was the same set. And we transmitted the information back to headquarters in Ceylon, which were manned again largely by Fannies.
Did you have a personal code name again?
No, just a team code name, Cow. That was the plan name, the radio plan name was Cow.
What was your team supposed to do?
Well, our objective, which was completely beyond us, on reviewing the situation, was to get into the town of Thaton, which wasn't a very big town, but that was our objective, but we just never made it. We discovered after we got there that the Japanese could see all our parachute drops from the main road. In fact, we were on their main line of retreat from Rangoon, and within walking distance was a Japanese transit camp. When I say walking distance, I mean 3 or 4 hours walk through the jungle. We sent back quite a lot of information because we were able to observe the transport on this main highway, because there were no other roads. And eventually we arranged an attack by two Hurricane bombers on the transit camp. And the Japanese obviously realized what we were doing. And they created a force which just looked for us, didn't do anything else. And they chased us all the time. We were never able to stop and really do any more meaningful work. So we were taken out by Lysander.
How was that accomplished?
We walked north for about 5 days and came to another team who had a fairly large encampment, because they were well away from the Japanese, and they created a small airstrip which they were able to land Lysander on. But it was quite a difficult journey to get there, and in fact we ran out of food about 3 days before we made it, and we were pretty hungry. Also, we lost the what we called the Jenny. It was like a steam generator which used to charge up the batteries, because it, obviously all the wireless operation was done by battery. And we lost that. And fortunately, I was just able to send a last message in clear, in plain English, to send the Jenny. And somebody at headquarters had their head screwed on right. We just managed to get this one drop in with some food and this Jenny, which enables us to start communicating again. But it was a difficult time. And it was at the tail end of the monsoon season. So we were fairly wet and miserable.
A steam generator, did you?
Yes. It was like a little boiler. And you lit a fire underneath.
With wood?
And then it ran this little engine, which charged the battery.
What were you supposed to do if you did get to the turn?
Well, we were supposed to control it, and I imagine that we would have probably got dropped by parachute forces there, who would have spread out into the surrounding area. But we just never got there.
Was there a Japanese garrison there?
I doubt whether it could be termed a garrison. There was probably Japanese soldiers in there, but it was unlikely a town that size would be garrisoned. The nearest garrison would have been Mul Mine, which was further south.
What did you make of the Burmese villagers in this area?
Oh, they were great. While we were in there, we in fact recruited a detachment of the Burmese National Army, who saw that the Japanese were going to suffer imminent defeat and promptly changed sides. But as soon as things started going wrong for us, they either deserted or were killed. And we had also had a small band of our own of about 30 guerrillas who we recruited ourselves. And strangely enough, we also had found about a dozen Indian soldiers who were in the Indian National Army, who also had deserted from the Japanese, and they joined us. But I never knew what became of them. They marched with us for quite a while, but I think they left us just as we got to the airstrip, because they were all frightened what was going to happen to them once they got back to India. Although I think they were pressured into the Indian National Army through ill treatment by the Japanese as prisoners of war.
What kind of religious background did they have?
I think they were Hindus.
Did they have turbans?
No. They had whatever they could lay their hands on. They didn't have proper uniforms.
They didn't have long hair?
No. No, they were mostly shaven, but whether that was a Japanese requirement, which it probably was, because the Japs all shaved their heads.
Their heads were bald?
Not bald, but short stubble.
What was the attitude of the Burmese villagers towards you, British people?
Yes, they were very cooperative. We passed through a number of villages. One or two where they'd probably never seen an Englishman before. But they were all offered their support, and I think this was largely due to this Burmese agent who was with us. He seemed to be able to contact them in advance so that they were ready for us to come in. But it seemed no sooner we got to a village than the Japanese were right behind us. We never seemed to be able to settle down and get our act together after that initial start that we had. I think we were pretty effective in what we did in the first few weeks that we were there. I think we did quite a lot of damage. But as I say, our eventual target of getting into Thattai was just never realisable. The area became untenable.
Did you gather how the Burmese civilians had fared under the Japanese occupation?
Yes. The people who generally supported us were Karens, and they suffered considerably under the Japanese.
Did they seem to be Christians or otherwise?
I think it's unlikely they were Christians. We had one or two witch doctors with us, I think, who seemed to provide any medicine that was required for the Karens. No, I'm sure they weren't Christian. But they were very friendly, smiling people. I got on very well with them, although I didn't speak the language.
What specifically had the Japanese done or not done to them?
Well, because a lot of them had their villages burnt, and a lot of them were wanted by the Japanese for subversive activities. Their families had been slaughtered.
Did you get any impression of the condition of the Japanese forces in your area?
Very poor. They were badly diseased. They were retreating as fast as they could from Rangoon. Yeah, they were in a bad way.
Did you capture any Japanese?
No. We had one or two heads brought to us that the local guerrillas had killed, largely as proof that they'd done it. That was all. We carried out one or two attacks on the highway with piats, but this was something additional that we had that we never had in France, piats, which we carted over and fired a few rounds into the transport coming down the highway. And I think it was this, combined with the air attack on the transit camp, that decided the Japanese they weren't going to put up with us any longer.
Were you firing at Japanese armour? Or
no, I never saw any armour. They were all lorries.
Did you personally fire a Pierce?
Yes.
How did you find it to operate?
Painful. It gave you a hell of a belt in the shoulder. But, you know, it was all right. It didn't... you didn't really get time to fire off too many rounds. You had to get in there and get out.
What about the physical conditions of life in southern Burma from the point of view of feeding and disease and health and so on?
Well, strangely enough, nearly everyone I spoke to in Force 136 had malaria, but I never did. I took my tablets, and although I was yellow to look at, I never caught malaria, and I think if I look back on it, I was probably the fittest I've ever been in all my life while I was in Burma. It's very strange, isn't it?
Yes.
But I was really fit and hard there.
Did you get dysentery?
No. Funny enough, it was something I never mentioned, but I had dysentery all the time I was in France. And I found that very difficult to cope with in the situation we were in. And I never recovered from it until the Americans overran us, and I was able to get to an American Army doctor, and he provided the medicine which seemed to clear it up. But in Burma, no, I was never had any illness at all.
How do you mean you found it difficult to cope with in France?
Well, in those days, of course, toilets were not the best in France, and there was absence of any sort of materials for washing and bathing yourself. It was awkward. But anyway, we coped. But in Burma, food-wise, generally the diet was rice, some tree roots perhaps, chicken if you happened to pass through a village. We shot one or two monkeys and ate those. I remember once we shot a barking deer and ate that. Plus bully beef and bits and pieces that we got on supply drops.
Now, I interrupted your narrative with you getting out of Burma, if you can take it on from there, please.
Yes. We walked up to another unit, which took us about 5 days, as I said, and they had created a small airstrip which Lysana was able to use, and that took us out. That's our team of three plus two Burmese agents. So in fact they crammed five of us plus the pilot into this Lysander and took us out to Rangoon.
When was that?
That was the end of April, 45.
I think that you told me that after that you were designated for a third operation.
That's right. In fact, as soon as I got back from Rangoon to Ceylon, I was asked to go to Malaya, but I suggested that, you know, I needed a couple of weeks to get over the previous lot, and eventually where I went in, I parachuted into Malaya in August 1945. This was a different sort of operation altogether because there were large, well-organized Chinese communist guerrilla units there, and we were really there as communications and liaison rather than in any sense in control of the situation. We provided supplies and sent back intelligence. But that was about it. They controlled themselves.
Which part of Malaya was this?
This was just south of Kuala Lumpur. And the code name of my plan there was Surrey.
Who were you with on this occasion?
Yes, the CO of the outfit was in fact a colonel on this occasion, and I think it was John Davis, who was well known post-war. And we also saw something of Spencer Chapman there, who again was well known.
What exactly did you see of Spencer Chapman?
Where?
What exactly did you see of him?
Well, I saw him once or twice going through our camp because we had a fairly major local commander there, a chap, I think, whose name was Yung Ping, who was quite an important local Chinese commander. And I think he came through from time to time to consult with him about what they were going to do. Because at that time, of course, we were preparing for a landing in Malaya, which never took place because the war ended. Incidentally, I made a mistake about the evacuation from Burma. It was in June 45.